It is Thursday, July 18th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, what's in a name? We learn where one local park gets its title. Plus, Abraham Lincoln through the eyes of a cat. Becca Martin Brown tells us what's up, and Birdman Joe Neal takes a poll.
But first, Senator John Bozeman says both Democrats and Republicans are working together to resolve the student loan interest rate increase on federal Stafford loans. The senator says a bipartisan group consisting of two Democrats, an independent, and three Republicans has come together to find a long-term agreement.
Trying to get a long-term commitment, a long-term fix, as opposed to just having another extension, which we did last year. Now we're back in the same situation, having a bill that will actually solve the problem so that our students can take advantage of these extraordinarily low interest rates so that they can lock these rates in for the life of their loans.
Senator Bozeman says he would really like to fix the issue instead of extending it. He says a proposal that would fix the problem would be great for students so they could get their loans behind them and have a situation where they can have stability.
Meanwhile, with 74 days before the end of the federal fiscal year, Senator Mike Pryor says time is running out for Congress to pass a comprehensive farm bill before provisions for farmers lapse when the current farm bill expires.
I'm very concerned that we're going to get into one of these stopgap worlds in agriculture, and that's not good for anybody, because at that point, nobody can plan, nobody can get a loan, nobody can do anything. It's just going to shut it down.
Senator Pryor says he feels that the House is being irresponsible, first in not passing a comprehensive bipartisan farm bill, and then by splitting off provisions for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known commonly as the food stamp program.
The way you fix this, the way you get a good ag policy on the books for the next 5 years, is to work together. Unfortunately, there's some in the House that say, you know, it's my way or the highway. And that is going to lead us to a dead end and to a crisis. It's not good. I hope the House will come together, and I hope they do it in a bipartisan way.
Senator Pryor says he was happy that three of Arkansas's four representatives voted for the comprehensive farm bill in late June. Though he didn't say it in specific terms, Senator Pryor derided Congressman Tom Cotton for voting against the bill, saying outside special interest groups like the Club for Growth that take anti-farm bill stances don't have Arkansas's best interests in mind. In the most recent filings with the Federal Election Commission, the Club for Growth has raised more than $74,000 for Congressman Cotton's 2014 campaign.
Governor Mike Beebe yesterday named a Harrison businessman as the newest member of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. The panel oversees hunting and fishing regulations in the state. Ken Reeves replaces outgoing Commissioner Ronald Pierce, and Reeves says he's looking forward to serving the state.
It is an honor, but more importantly to me, it's an opportunity to do something I've wanted to do for a very long time, and that's to give something back for all the good times, good friends, and good memories that have come my way through my outdoor experiences in Arkansas.
In recent years, the Game and Fish Commission has been embroiled in several controversies and low employee morale. Reeves says he will work to restore public trust and says he believes the best days of that commission are ahead.
Today, Arkansas hosts its second annual summit addressing prescription drug abuse. Physicians, pharmacists, law enforcement, and government officials are expected to attend at the Statehouse Convention Center in Little Rock. This year's keynote speaker is R. Gil Karlukowski, the nation's drug czar. Arkansas's drug director, Fran Fleener, says in 2007, Karlukowski's office identified the state as number one in the nation for prescription pain pill abuse for 12 to 17-year-olds. She says abuse of prescription medication is widespread.
There's no one segment of society that is more affected than the other. Then you have the myth of safety. So we're trying to get people to realize that if prescription pills are abused, they're just as dangerous as any form of illicit drug.
Fleener says people who get prescriptions should monitor, secure, and dispose of their pills properly so that they don't reach in the wrong hands.
In May, we brought you a story about a partnership aimed at improving pedestrian and arts infrastructure in downtown Fayetteville. The partnership involved the City of Fayetteville, the Fayetteville Chamber of Commerce, and the University of Arkansas Community Design Center. Yesterday, the National Endowment for the Arts awarded a $100,000 grant to the partnership. Steve Luoni, the director of the Community Design Center, says the grant will help the center conduct a study on transforming the face of School Avenue, as well as other parcels in the immediate vicinity.
And basically there are two components, a streetscape plan that will look at a street that really is made for traffic right now, but with our design hopefully become more pedestrian oriented and becomes a street that hosts festivals and parades. The second component is preparation of a mixed-use development, mostly of housing, including housing for artists on the what is now currently a surface parking lot for the Walton Arts Center.
The grant was awarded as part of the National Endowment for the Arts 2013 Our Town Grant Program. This year, 59 projects in 36 states received a total of $4.7 million through the program. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals finished a four-game road series last night in Tulsa. The Nats lost to the Drillers 4-3. They'll return home to Arvest Ballpark tonight for a seven-game homestand, beginning with a four-game series against the Springfield Cardinals. One note about last night's game: in that contest, the Naturals starting pitcher, Danny Duffy, struck out 13 Driller batters. That's a new franchise record.
According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, drought conditions have worsened in Arkansas during the last week. Although the past few days have seen sporadic showers in some areas, 91% of the state is at least abnormally dry. Nearly 47% is under moderate drought conditions, and severe drought conditions have developed in just more than 7% of the state, including portions of Carroll, Boone, Madison, Newton, and Searcy counties. Only 9% of Arkansas is under no drought conditions, and that area is isolated to the northeastern corner of the state.
Partly cloudy tonight. Lows will be in the upper 60s in northwest Arkansas. For the Arkansas River Valley, slight chance of showers this evening, possibly a thunderstorm before 10 o'clock. Lows tonight in the mid-70s for the River Valley. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs will be around 93 in northwest Arkansas. For the Arkansas River Valley, slight chance of afternoon thunderstorms. Highs in the upper 90s. Heat index around 103 tomorrow afternoon for the River Valley. And tomorrow night, mostly clear. Lows throughout the region from 69 to 74. This is Ozarks at Large. This week, the Fayetteville Visitors Bureau released a new pocket-sized waterproof fold-out map for the city's trails and bikeways. Linking up trails, sidewalks, and some streets, the guide can direct cyclists, runners, and pedestrians to the best routes to get around town. The free guides became available just days before work began on an important link in the city's trail system, a tunnel underneath busy Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard that will extend the much-used Skull Creek and Frisco Trail links further south into the city. Yesterday, I met with Matt Mihalovich, trails coordinator for the city of Fayetteville, as the work began on that tunnel. He says the guide uses color coordination to explain the different types of trails inside Fayetteville.
Similar to skiing, ski slopes, we use the green color for the easiest. We thought, okay, families, bike trailers should be comfortable. These are low volume residential, low speed limits.
Bunny trails, as if they were on the slopes.
If they were on the slopes, yeah, good analogy. And then blue for more moderate, and then the red, difficult connections, looking at Weddington, places like that, Mission, Old Wire. They're on there, they make connections, but they're difficult, and we hope to improve those in future years. And then, of course, all the trails are on the guide, including the mountain bike trail, and just a real nice map. It actually won an award at the GIS conference, it's ESRI conference, a third place in its category just recently, out of a large pool. So we're just really excited.
Mihalovich says the work that began yesterday morning at MLK is a critical part of the city trails because the section he calls the spine of the city's trail system has for years ended right at this busy street.
Yeah, I mean, it's not good enough just to say this is where it ends. I think we've seen with the support from the citizens the overwhelming popularity of the trails. Now we're seeing it expanding throughout the region. So it's not good enough to say this is where it is.
Where the current trail meets MLK, the city will be building walls and ramping the trail about 10 feet under the current grade level to get under the busy street and then back up on the other side. Matt Mihalovich says there is an 8-month contract window for completion of the project. The tunnel construction is the first part.
In anticipation of having it in before the first football game, which is August 31st. So that's the big goal, the big push. Just like everyone else around here with the new student housing, everybody's trying to rush to get done before the mad rush comes back with the university starting back and the football, bikes and barbie, all those things that we have in fall in Fayetteville.
If the 8-month plan is met, the city's trail system will, by spring, have an important hub connecting trails on the north side of town to trails on the south side. Already, the south side has several trails either finished or on the drawing board.
Heading west, that'll continue past under 540 at MLK and on to the west, and then on the east side, Walker Park, and then we're going to extend, there's an extension of Walker Park down to Town Branch Trail, and then Town Branch is a real nice east-west trail that follows the Town Branch Creek, so really just connecting all the south part to everything going on up north.
The work beginning at Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard this week is part of the master plan, a concept that would eventually have about 100 miles of trails inside city limits. As Matt Mihaljevic points out, the grand plan is a decades-long project, but the past year has seen accomplishments. A paved trail circling Veterans Park on the north side of the city is now done.
We also have the mountain bike trail, single track, that's been upgraded by volunteer efforts. So really two trails out there, really a great resource at Lake Fayetteville. People are loving it.
Within a few months, the city will bid out the Town Branch Trail project on the south side of Fayetteville. That will connect South School Street to parks on the south side of town, as well as provide a trail along the University of Arkansas Research Park, and eventually, after other phases of construction, connect to one of the largest parks in town, Walker Park.
So we have that one. Currently, our trail crew is working over at Porter Road, under 540, making the connection to the Meadow Valley Trail. To make that western connection under the interstate, that's been real kind of a little pinch point there, and just getting through that. I mentioned the Salt Lake Trail. That's our crew is going to move and work on it, about a 1.5 mile trail on a rail line just south of MLK, and they expect to have that finished by the end of the year.
The city continues to monitor trail use through two movable infrared counters put on various trails. Mihaljevic says the average traffic count for School Creek is above 600 users daily, though Sundays can reach into the thousands. The Fayetteville trails are actually just part of the story in northwest Arkansas. Earlier this month, the Springdale City Council approved a plan to use eminent domain to allow access for trail building in that city. That decision means the last links in a 36-mile trail from South Fayetteville to the northern edge of Bentonville have now been secured.
Looking pretty positive to be able to have that spring opening of the whole 36 miles, which includes our piece here and all the way up to actually up into Bella Vista, around Lake Bella Vista. So basically from Walker Park to Lake Bella Vista. And it's going to be incredible.
Matt Mihaljevic is the trails coordinator for the city of Fayetteville. He spoke yesterday at the site of construction for a tunnel that will go underneath Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Fayetteville.
And this is Ozarks at Large. Today we start sort of a new series.
We do.
Monthly series.
It's one that we have talked about as a staff for some time. It's one I have thought about for a long time.
Well, there are a lot of places in northwest Arkansas and our entire listening area that, I mean, everything has a name.
Right. And where do those names come from? It could be as simple as not too far from where you and I are sitting right now, there is Leroy Pond Drive, a street in Fayetteville. It's kind of connected to campus. In Mena, there's Queen Wilhelmina State Park.
Right.
Queen Wilhelmina was a real person on another continent. We're going to try to find out at some point.
Why in Mena is that named?
Yeah. Jenny Lynn in Fort Smith. Jenny Lynn was a famous singer in the early part of the 20th century. From what I understand, never appeared in Fort Smith. Why is that called Jenny Lynn? So the opportunities are almost limitless, well, what we could find out.
And even, you know, we're sitting in the Carver Center for Public Radio.
Right, right.
You know, who are the Carvers?
Right, well, we could tell you that
at some
point.
Yeah, we could.
They're very good people.
So I went just down the street a few blocks, actually, not down the street, but just not far from where we're sitting, to Wilson Park to find out who Mr. Wilson was, or Mrs. Wilson.
Right. So. Not the neighbor to Dennis the Menace.
Right. Groups of children attend swimming lessons on a sunny summer morning in the Wilson Pool at Wilson Park in Fayetteville. The kids, and their teachers for that matter, probably don't know the city's oldest and largest park's history, or where it gets its name. Lucky for them and us, Jerry Hogan, author, historian, and native Fayettevillian, does. As it turns out, the city park can be traced back to 1906 and to someone other than a Wilson. I met Mr. Hogan in the parking lot near the castle and the baseball field.
We are standing in the original city park that A.L. Trent, it was his private property, and he operated it for the city, which I love. I love about him. He's one of my favorite people in Fayetteville history. Very civic-minded. It was his own private property, and he operated it for the city as a park. That's pretty cool.
From Park Street to the driveway by the tennis courts, and from Prospect to Louise, the 5 1/8 acres were owned and operated by the bank cashier and real estate man, Albert Trent. We have him to thank for many of the trees in this area. According to his daughter, he planted over 2,000 of them. The baseball field was once called Trent's Pond, diverted spring water that made the city's swimming hole. Home plate was a slide. The dugouts, bathhouses. Up until the early 1920s, residents could swim for a quarter, 20 cents if you brought your own bathing suit. In the mid-1920s, Dr. Noah Drake, of Drake Field, formed the City Park Company and purchased the property from Trent. The park became a corporate-owned amenity.
The first thing they did was they built a little tourist camp over here. They see these stone buildings here on the west side of the original park, if you will. For the new automobile tourism industry was developing then, which is also quaint and kind of fun. And they were neat little things. All we have left are these stone buildings, but they're original from that time.
Those buildings are now used for storage and offices of the city's horticulture department. When Dr. Drake and his corporation took over, they also built the pool that the children are swimming in this morning, though it has gone through many facelifts since 1928. In 1944, the city of Fayetteville purchased the land from Dr. Drake, and the park truly became a city park. This brings us to the Wilson family, notably Charles Murrow Wilson,
whose family used to own everything from this in the park all the way over to Wilson Avenue, all the way up to Maple Street, back up behind us here up through Woolsey. And Charles Morrow Wilson's family actually lived right up here. He grew up right here on Woolsey, right up here. His grandfather, A.M. Wilson, Alfred M. Wilson, his home stood where the Pi-Fi house is at the corner of Maple and Wilson. That was at the northeast corner of Maple and Wilson. That was where he was one of the early settlers of Fayetteville, almost from the beginning.
The original Mr. Wilson, Alfred M., was a lawyer and an entrepreneur, and also briefly the mayor of Fayetteville. One side of the family was very political. Charles Murrow Wilson, however, was an internationally known author. He wrote the novels Acres of Sky and Rabble Rouser, as well as authored numerous articles in journals such as Reader's Digest and Life. In 1945, he sold Wilson's Pasture to the city for $15,500. The 16 7/8 acres from the tennis courts and on west to Wilson Avenue helped the park to grow to the 22 acres it remains today. When he sold the land, Wilson had a couple of stipulations.
It was right at the end, all of it took place right at the end of World War II, and there was a gigantic influx of veterans coming back to go to college. And so the city, Mayor George Sanders, had rented space. Now, this, it didn't look like this at all then still. There was no ball field. They had rented all this area, and it had trailers everywhere, up on the hill, out on the Wilson's pasture, everywhere. And Charles Morrow Wilson didn't like that at all. He wanted this to be a beautiful park named after his mother, Mattie Morrow Wilson, is the actual real name of this park, is Mattie Morrow Wilson Park. That's what he wanted. And he wanted it to be a lovely place. So he didn't like the trailers, and I can kind of go with him on that.
Fights ensued over both issues. There were talks of building a boys' club here. Wilson wanted it to be a pretty park used by everyone. And the name? It remained Fayetteville City Park for years.
And that's the interesting part to me. When I grew up here as a child, this was City Park, Odin Wilson Park, but it had actually been officially, should have been Wilson Park since 1946 at the very latest, but it was still City Park. It didn't get officially named Wilson Park until 1969 because of the rancor created between the city of Fayetteville and Charles Morrow Wilson over those issues I talked about.
Hogan says Wilson was part of Fayetteville's generation of distinction, around the same time as and friends with Senator J. William Fulbright and architect Edward Durrell Stone. Though Wilson passed away in 1977, Hogan thinks he would be happy with Wilson Park. That is, Matty Morrow Wilson Park, today.
I think it would be kind of what I think he would like the way it is right now, tell you the truth. I think this is nice.
It wasn't until 1980 that the familiar castle, officially titled Point 7 by artist Frank Williams, was dedicated. This whimsical feature sits over a spring that feeds into the reflecting pool and Skull Creek, the creek that runs through the middle of the park. And if you've ever wondered where Skull Creek got its name...
That's actually named, when you first see it, you go, Skull Creek, we got somebody dead in here or something. No, it's named after Reverend William Skull, who I believe, I can't remember his denomination, but he gave like the first sermon of one of the churches here in town. I want to say Presbyterian, but I might be wrong. But he was from out of town, and he came here, and he preached here and stayed here. And I think they give him credit for maybe delivering the first official sermon in the town of Fayetteville. So that's why Skull Creek, not because somebody died or something. It's the man's name.
I was also curious about Lake Wilson, a park on the southeast side of town, if it was once owned by the same Wilson family. Hogan did some digging with old maps and property records.
And it says that land over there, right around Wilson Lake or Lake Wilson, whichever they call it, belonged to the estate of W.F. Wilson, which is William F. Wilson, who, to my knowledge, has no connection whatsoever to the Charles Morrow Wilson side of this.
Lake Wilson was dammed to be used as a water source for the city of Fayetteville in the 1920s. That dam is commonly called Tilly Willie Bridge, most likely after William Wilson's wife, Matilda, or Tilly Willie.
Our What's in a Name series will air about once a month on Ozarks at Large. If you're curious about why something or someplace has the name it does, send us an email at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com, and perhaps we'll select that for our next What's in a Name.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, thousands of athletes are gathering in Cleveland to run marathons, swim, and pole vault. The youngest are in their 50s, the oldest 90+. And there's this 64-year-old who competes to keep in shape.
Sometimes I go pick up my grandkids. You know, some people think I'm a mom.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, just ahead, beginning at 1 this afternoon on KUAF 91.3 FM.
The small town of Pinhook, Missouri, population of about 65, was completely destroyed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in 2011. A few former residents have campaigned to relocate and rebuild their community. Tamara Zellers-Buck from content partner KRCU has more.
I'm standing on the parking lot of Union Baptist Church in Pinhook, Missouri. Like most rural churches, it's quiet and serene here, a natural sanctuary. But at this tiny bricked chapel, the walls are broken, the pews are missing, and weeds are overtaking the concrete lot. Like the once close-knit community of Pinhook itself, the church and its people are gone.
I was concerned about the others because they didn't have no place, you know.
That's 78-year-old George Williams, Pinhook's oldest resident. In 2011, Pinhook was sacrificed to the Mississippi River to save larger towns from rising floodwaters. The community's problem was that it sits in the Birds Point New Madrid floodway, which was created as part of a federal flood risk management act to minimize loss of lives and property during historic floods.
They were scattered everywhere. They were in Charleston, Saxton, some of them was in Wide. Different place where you can find any place to stay, you know, they had to get out of there.
Some 35 Pinhook residents had less than a day to evacuate their homes when the Army Corps of Engineers intentionally breached the levee. All residents evacuated safely, but took very little property with them.
Everybody got along down there and everything. Everybody tried to keep the property up. And everybody had flowers and things there, and they put flowers down. And you could just walk from house to house and talk to people there in that project.
2 years later, Pinhook remains a ghost town. What the river didn't ruin, vandals destroyed by fire to gain access to copper and anything valuable. Residents are displaced and dissatisfied, but determined to put their community back together.
We had a Memorial Day there, and you have a big to-do there and everything, and kids had to play. You could turn the kid loose over there in the churchyard, and they could run and play. Nobody involved. When they get tired, they come home.
The village board continues to meet monthly at a restaurant in Mississippi County to discuss how people are faring and what needs they have. Village chairwoman Deborah Tarver says her people want to remain both physically and mentally close. To make this happen, they have worked with private, state, and federal agencies to obtain approval and funding for a government buyout. That's necessary because no homes can be insured or rebuilt in the floodway unless they are elevated 8 feet from the ground. The village submitted a community block development grant application to Missouri officials in March. If approved, Penhook will be resettled outside of the floodway.
Penhook will never die in my heart, and in a lot of Penhookians' heart. Officially on paper, it's still there until the state tells us it's not. So we're not giving up until they say it's not. And then probably we'll find a way to do something to try to get back together.
New Penhook.
Right, and be Penhook again.
Tarver wants residents to keep their spirits up until they can rebuild and regain that sense of home lost to the floodwaters. For KRCU, I'm Tamara Zellers-Bug.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callum.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Nationally syndicated talk show host Jerry Springer, also former mayor of Cincinnati, Jerry Springer, is coming back to Northwest Arkansas next month. He is going to be the Arkansas CW celebrity guest at the August 2nd Northwest Arkansas Naturals game at Arvest Ballpark. He'll throw out the first pitch. There's a cheap line here about throwing a chair, because isn't his show the one where people...
Yes.
With chairs.
Yes. I know they get very, very excited.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
It's apparently still on the air. I guess that's why the Arkansas CW is having him as their guest.
I think so. I think it's on every day at noon, actually.
Yes. All right. Well,
but
he'll
we're
be back
here. So.
That's right. Yeah. You don't know about that because you listen to us at noon. But he will be at Arvest Ballpark on the 2nd.
All right. Camp Lost Bridge is now open on Beaver Lake. It's a newly renovated area within Lost Bridge North Park. It allows groups to come together in a more primitive setting than the traditional, you know, I guess, I don't know, RVs
camping,
and camping.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess it's a little bit more rustic, but they're excited about it. So you can reserve that by calling 877-444-6777 or go to recreation.gov. You can camp there between October and March 31st.
Okay. Today's show has a real outdoor flair. Wilson Park, the trails in Fayetteville, later Joe Neal. Keeping in that vein, a reminder that the Gully Park Summer Concert Series in the city of Fayetteville continues tonight. Tonight's guest from out of town, Wheeler Brothers from Austin, Texas. They're known for sort of an Americana roots and blues sound. The concert begins tonight at 7, as is the case with all Gully Park concerts. It's free. Also, north of Gully Park in Bentonville, it's around the block. A lot more free live music up there.
All right. I visited Tyson Foods earlier this week to talk about their art collection, and I learned that they have an entire group of chaplains.
Yes.
I didn't know that. But they have recently named a new director of chaplain services. Michael Tarvin will lead more than 120 workplace chaplains. He replaces Chaplain Rick McKinney, who's retiring. He was also a senior chaplain of Multinational Corps in Iraq, where he supervised more than 300 chaplains in combat operations. So.
Speaking of new appointees, another one, Susan Tunneyman is going to be the director of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Arkansas. She was formerly the director of the Beck Pride Center for America's Wounded Veterans at Arkansas State University in Jonesboro. She also served on Governor Mike Beebe's Arkansas Yellow Ribbon Task Force that focused on issues faced by returning veterans.
My stepfather loves to go to those Ollie classes.
Oh, they're fantastic.
Yeah.
They're fantastic.
He's retired, and so he spends some days at,
some
the Continuing Education Center. Yeah. Another music note, Dam Arkansan will perform at the Pied Piper Cat House Lounge in Eureka Springs this Saturday from 8 p.m. to midnight.
And this reminder, you have not quite 24 hours left to register for the free season tickets to the Alma Performing Arts Center through KUAF. Go to KUAF.com, enter your information. You could win two tickets to every one of the Alma PAC concerts. We are going to announce that winner tomorrow at noon on Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. Pat Carr has written more than a dozen books, fiction and nonfiction, and had over 100 short stories published. Her latest book is something a bit different. It's a graphic novel about one of the most infamous moments in American history, the assassination of President Lincoln. And it's told from a cat's perspective. In fact, Horatio the Cat receives top billing over Pat on the cover of the book, Lincoln, Booth, and Me, a graphic novel of the assassination. We were unable to schedule an interview with Horatio, so we invited Pat Carr to the Carver Center for Public Radio. She's with me now. Welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Thank you.
Has Horatio become something of a prima donna now that he has a book?
He's very disdainful.
Yes. Where did the idea for a graphic novel about the assassination come from?
I was writing a regular novel, and I found out that in Mary Surratt's boarding house, where the conspirators in quotes, mm-hmm. met, there was this little girl named Mary Apollonia Dean. And I thought this would be an interesting book to write from the little girl's point of view looking at the assassination. But it got very contrived. I wanted her to be, you know, at the Ford's Theater, at the Garrett Farm.
And how could you do that? Believably.
Not believably. So that I came up with who could be all those places, and it was a cat. Dogs are noticeable, but cats are not.
With a graphic novel, it seems like you can move along quickly.
Yes. That was part of its charm, is that I think the problem with most literary fiction right now is that it's gotten so interior, and there's no scene. And, you know, as any writer knows, you can write anything if you can write a scene. And so the graphic novel really forces you to do scenes. And they do, as you say, you can move fast.
When I was a kid, there were things called Classics Illustrated.
I remember those, yes.
And I guess the idea was I would pick up Amazing Spider-Man or the Fantastic Four. Oh, and what's this comic book about Tale of Two Cities?
Right.
Or Hunchback of Notre Dame. And I see this, I mean, I am now 50, so I enjoyed the book as not a child, but I see this as something that could introduce a very young person to history.
That's kind of what I hoped. And I've got a friend in Kentucky who wrote back and said, hey, this would be ideal for introducing middle school or even younger, sixth grade, to history. Because I'm a real scholar. I was a joint English history major in college, and it's got to be accurate.
Well, I was going to say, I've read a handful of books about the Lincoln assassination, at least dealt partly with it, the Manhunt and some other books about Lincoln.
American Brutus.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And you pack a lot of information in here that, you know, in what, four dozen pages and panels.
Right.
I mean, you made sure you got little bits of information in there.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was hoping, and without too much dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is another thing you got to be careful with in a graphic novel. You can't talk for pages.
How did you decide what you could get in and what would have been too much?
I did a mock-up, and I had about 60 pages, and I was trying to put in all those little things and the funeral procession and all of those things that I knew about. It just got too much, and so I pared and pared and pared. And, you know, I love to revise anyway. So finally, I got it down to where I thought it would work.
Which came easier for you, the words or the images? Because you drew the pictures.
Yes. Probably the words. I've been writing much longer.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 13, my father came in and he said, you draw and you write, you got to pick one. You can't be great in both. You've either got to be an artist or you've got to be a writer. And I decided I wrote more than I drew.
But now?
Yeah. I can relax and do both. But Malcolm Gladwell says you've got to do a million words to be a writer. You've got to work 10,000 hours at any other craft to be a success. And I think that's what my father was trying to say. You don't have that many hours.
This is a violent episode, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This is an assassination. And later, I think I can don't have to worry about spoiling the ending for some people, but John Wilkes Booth meets a violent death as well.
And a very similar to Lincoln's, which
yes.
I thought was very ironic.
So when you're thinking about young people looking at this, you don't want to candy coat.
Right.
But on the other hand, I mean, you're talking about two people who are assassinated by one very violently in the head, another who basically drowns in his own blood.
Right.
So how did you balance that would be for a young audience?
Because I wanted the cat to look at them both sympathetically. And I want them to understand that an assassin has his, nothing happens without motive. And the assassin has his own reasons for doing this. And as a friend wrote, and she said, the fact that you call, that the cat calls him Johnny, mm-hmm. humanizes him. So that I wanted a kid to recognize this is a human being too.
Are you prepared for some people being upset with that?
Yes.
I'm not going to spoil the last image in the book, but I'm going to ask you about it because it surprised me.
Oh, did it?
Not in that it was there, because that's how the story ends.
Right.
But the caption, I won't spoil that either. I don't know. It was a bit more, maybe sympathetic is too strong a word, but there, the caption of what's going on is a bit more ambiguous than history would let us lead us to think.
Right. And I probably did that on purpose. And the one before it is a prisoner in a hood. And it reminded me so much of the Abu Ghraib. I kind of intended that. You know, look, we've been making mistakes a lot. And so I did that one on purpose. And I did the last one on purpose, too.
Well, I figured you did.
Yeah.
It was maybe just even a bit shocking for me.
Oh, that's good. That is kind of what I wanted. Because I took it from a Matthew Brady photograph, and I was trying to do it as accurately as possible.
You do have a cat named Horatio in real life.
In real life, he's named Kalidasa.
Okay.
I wanted to preserve his anonymity.
Which we've now blown.
Yes.
You made... Your cat is black. You made the cat Horatio in the book, the storyteller, black. And a couple times it's referred to as bad luck.
Right. I sort of wanted that superstition in there. Because everybody has bad luck.
Mm-hmm.
In the assassination, it's permeating.
Save General Grant.
Exactly. He didn't go to the play. And my son-in-law read this one, and he said, I've put in here at the end that Horatio's on his seventh life in a farm in Arkansas. And my son-in-law said, where are the other six?
So if there's another Horatio story, if this was the first, you don't even say if this was the first,
right.
Actually.
Right. I could back up.
Right. Have you given thought to what else Horatio may have witnessed?
I thought pretty much right away that maybe the Salem witch...
Oh.
trials would be Horatio, as you know.
Horatio is bad luck.
Yes.
Horatio's hanging around some tough times.
So, and you know, the witches had familiars, and he could be one of those that witnesses this. And I've got a friend who is a descendant of Rebecca Nurse, who was one of them who was killed. And I don't know if she was hanged or pressed to death.
Yeah.
But you know, I write from incident, and I would have to find a really compelling moment in the witch trials, the way I think this one is.
Are you working on anything else right now?
I'm writing one more Civil War story before I get away. I did a whole bunch of research on gangrene, and the nurses over here at the wound center were so kind, and they would let me come witness, you know, when they found somebody, they'd call me, there's somebody with gangrene. And I sat through the lectures on, and I thought, gee, I'd like to use it. So I've set it in 1864 when the war is winding down, and the Confederate soldier has gangrene. Can the heroine save him or not? Mm.
Hypothetical question that you may not have an answer to, but if I could give you a year and an unlimited budget to go anywhere and research anything for a book, fiction or nonfiction, do you have a dream, subject
place?
Or assignment?
Oh, that's a lovely question. I got all involved in the Black Plague, the Black Death, and it got to Europe in 1348, and it came to Bordeaux first, and the English princess was on her way to marry the Prince of Spain, and she got caught in the Black Death, and they set the Bordeaux on fire to try to get rid of it. And where she was staying burned to the ground, and they've never found the body of her or the young minstrel whom the prince had sent to entertain her on the way. So I've decided they have run off together before the Bordeaux burned. So I took my daughters and we went to Bordeaux. Just had to go look at the place. But I don't have one in mind.
Okay, that's okay.
That's a great question, though.
Okay, assassination, witch trials... The plague. Pat, Lollipops, sunshine, rainbows,
I
where?
Know, I know.
Just not as interesting, right?
You've got to have a conflict. And when I wrote my memoir, people said, well, you didn't bring in your children. I never had a conflict with my children.
Right. Yeah. What a wonderful thing to hear.
But, yeah, I loved them unconditionally. And they're all wonderful, beautiful. What good is it writing about them?
Pat Carr, congratulations and thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Pat Carr will discuss her new graphic novel and sign copies of the book at Nightbird Books in downtown Fayetteville on Saturday, August 10th.
Hey, speak for yourself. It's a term that's often said in disagreement when another person is voicing their opinion as that of others. It's also the name of a storytelling speaker series that takes place tomorrow evening in Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Emily Gallahan spoke with those behind the new event and has this report.
Anyone with a story to share has an opportunity to do so this Friday at the Speak for Yourself open mic event. The way it works is simple. The storyteller gets 3 to 5 minutes to tell a true story of an experience they've had, with no scripts or memorized performances. It's the speaker's own words, off the top of their head. Rechna Muldoon, who's the director of the Big Picture House and co-producer of Speak for Yourself, says every story is a good story.
People tell stories that are funny and some that are sad and some that are just kind of about nothing, and somehow they're all just really great in different ways. We haven't had a bad story yet.
Muldoon works with fellow producer and founder of the Artists Laboratory Theater, Erica Wilhite. The two of them based the idea off a show they both liked called The Moth. Wilhite says it was an experiment. They were trying to bring something new to Fayetteville, and the show was an instant success.
Back in March, my theater company built a giant sheet fort, and we were hosting performing groups in the sheet fort, and that was one show that we wanted to bring, so we decided to give it a shot, and we kept this format really simple, and you could tell your story if your name was pulled out of a hat, and we were surprised at how many people showed up and at how many people put their name in the hat.
After the first show, the turnout for the event kept growing. Now the storytellers are still put in a hat and drawn at random, but there isn't enough time for all of them to speak. The storytellers whose names are pulled get to tell any story that they want to share. And even though a lot of the stories told throughout the night are funny and thought-provoking, not all of the stories have to be. Muldoon says that the storytellers don't have to be writers or comedians. It can be anyone.
I think that I can speak to this really well because I'm not artistic at all. Like, I don't have talent. So I'm not a singer or a poet or an actor. And I think it's different because it's just so accessible to anyone in the community. And there's no pretentiousness to it at all.
At the end of the evening, after the stories are told, a comedy improv group called Sound Effects will do a performance which is loosely based on the stories they've heard throughout the evening. And just like Speak for Yourself is a unique open mic experience, Sound Effects is different from other improv groups. They use music in their shows. So basically, the group listens to the stories and takes phrases or characters from them to create an improvised performance, complete with musical instruments. Jason Sewell, a member of Sound Effects, explains their role in the event.
We're not recreating the stories that have been told. So we're not just simply like telling the story again, except with different people, because that would kind of be defeating, I think, the purpose. You know, the moment is for the person who told the story. That's their moment. Our job is to take all of those together, throw them in the bowl, mix them all up, and see what comes out.
Sound Effects has performed during Speak for Yourself before, and Sewell says that the shows complement each other.
We always want audiences for our stories, but rarely do we have the chance to like all gather around like a campfire and like listen to my story of this crazy thing that happened to me. The whole evening has elements of surprise and improvisation in it. It's a great relationship, I think, between those two halves of the evening.
That campfire feel is exactly the experience that Speak for Yourself is aiming for. Co-producer Erica Wilhite says that the environment feels more like a conversation with friends than a performance.
That's why I think it's successful, is that it is a great shared experience. It's we were telling stories that we all in some way or another relate to, and we're together when we're listening to them.
Everyone who attends Speak for Yourself doesn't have to tell a story. Many just come to listen. And if you change your mind during the show and think of something to say, you can add your name to the drawing. The show is free this Friday at the Fayetteville Underground in downtown Fayetteville at 8 p.m. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Emily Gallahan.
This is Ozarks at Large. Recently, our favorite birdman, Joe Neal, took a poll on behalf of the proposed Mount Kessler Preserve.
That was a summer tanager in the recording. Old-timers in the Ozarks call them summer red birds. This distinguished them from cardinals that live here all year. Summer red birds only come to nest in our old forest and then head back south. The singing is from atop Kessler Mountain in southeast Fayetteville. That's 30 seconds as a tanager flies from the university campus and that energetic mass of businesses surrounding and extending beyond. Frank Sharp and other advocates of public green space want to protect at least 400 rocky hilltop acres on Kessler as a natural area. I think the red-eyed vireos that we heard in that last recording probably agree. They are forest birds, don't thrive midst parking lots, don't need any science labs or stadiums. To test Frank's idea, I've come up on the mountain to conduct a kind of Gallup poll among the birds. That soft calling involves a family of blue-gray gnatcatchers, one size up from a hummer. They weave nests from soft plant down, held together with threads of spider web, and stick pieces of lichen on the outside. The nest, in short, is woven from the very fabric of wild Kessler. The nest looks like a natural bump on the limb of Kessler's chestnut oaks. Part of me wants to say that's what all those excited calls are about. They want the natural area. But five gnatcatchers moving among small trees and big rocks tells me it's a family group, young, just out of the nest. I'm over there with the microphone doing my poll. There's a bright blue bird on a leafless limb, a male indigo bunting. He pours bright, warbly doublets across a hollow running off the mountain, and another indigo answers. I find it hard to reconcile wild birds with what's happening below. I just need to think for a minute. I've piled down on a big lichen-covered rock. I see our busy, built-up urban dreams spread below. Mass ranks of paved streets, strip malls, big box stores, hamburger joints, liquor stores, utility easements, rent to owns. A growing university with growing opportunities for all of us. My own house is out there, too. What's left is Kessler. As far as I can judge from all the singing, the birds favor green Kessler. The rest is up to us.
Joe Neal is co-author of Arkansas Birds, published by the University of Arkansas Press. His latest book, In the Province of Birds, a Western Arkansas memoir, is published by Half Acre Press.
It is Thursday, July 18th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and with me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
How can it be halfway through July?
I was saying that last week, like when July 10th hit, I was just like, whoa.
The summer is flying. I feel like a little kid.
It's totally flying by.
Okay.
I wish I were a little kid, though.
I know.
No work days.
The beach experience in New Orleans. actually on Ship Island outside of Gulfport, has made me want to be a little kid. Mm. But that's neither here nor there. Tonight, things to do in Northwest Arkansas. Speak for Yourself, the new open mic community storytelling experience, happens at 8 o'clock at the Fayetteville Underground. If you don't know about this, you should email Erica with a K at artlabtheaterre.com and find out more about it. I'd love to go. It's fascinating. It's just a chance to get up and tell your story.
Anybody.
Anybody. And Band of Heathens plays tonight at George's Majestic Lounge. They are supposed to have a new studio album this fall following their live album, The Double Down, from last year. Our music writer Kevin Kinder describes them as country rock jam. I don't know what that means.
That sounds good.
Okay, good. Okay. 9 o'clock, George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville, $10 tickets.
All right. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
La Morte di Durane, a composition from a young Rossini, is not that well known, but it is quite dramatically delightful. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of Note, Monday through Friday from 11 to noon, right here on KUAF. Join me Friday for La Morte di Durane from Rossini. That's coming up 11 to noon Friday, right here on KUAF.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle. The 15th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Series continues with the Composer Showcase, the music of Rick Salonen, at Walton Arts Center Star Theater on Saturday, July 27th. This performance will present the compositions and arrangements of Dr. Rick Salonen, performed by duos, trios, quartets, and quintets from local jazz artists, including the 18-piece Fayetteville Jazz Collective. Tickets and more information are available online at KUAF.com.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville.
And Turner's Bend.
Turner's Bend. Okay, that's on the past Elkins.
Yes. It's on Highway 23 inside the National Forest. I thought, since we were talking about a lot of outdoor things, mm-hmm. Turner's Bend to me is kind of the quintessential outdoor place in our listening area. Not too far from Paradise, both figuratively and literally. Paradise is a bit south on Highway 23.
And it's on the way to Mulberry Mountain also, right?
Yeah. Speaking of KUAF.com, don't forget that you have a few hours left to enter to win the season tickets to the Alma Performing Arts Center season pass.
I know. Soji Tabuchi and
Helen Reddy. And several other things. You can go to the Alma Performing Arts Center website, or you can go to our website and see what the season is. So these will be two free tickets to each of the events that takes place at the Alma Performing Arts Center in the 2013-2014 season. We will give those passes away tomorrow to one lucky entrant during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large.
All right. Bridges to Wellness, a community health nonprofit based in Siloam Springs. They're actually the organization that's behind the new outdoor gym in Siloam Springs.
Which you visited, yes.
Bridges to Wellness will be offering the nationally known 6-week healthy cooking course, Cooking Matters for Families. It begins this Saturday at 11:30 at the Siloam Springs Farmers Market. Cooking Matters is a fun way for families to come together to learn about and sample delicious, healthy foods. For more information, visit bridgestowellness.org or call 479-549-3143.
And talking about healthy food, that leads me to remind you that an Ozarks Slow Food Fund Your Farmers benefit takes place Sunday evening from 5 until 7 at Greenhouse Grill in Fayetteville. The ticket price includes live music by Threepenny Acre, 8 dishes prepared from 4 local chefs, plus there will be a silent auction. Proceeds fund a new microgrants program for local farmers. Space is limited. If you want to know more, you can go to ozarkslowfood.org.
And just one quick note, tomorrow is the third Friday of July.
Yes, it
is. And Rogers celebrates the third Friday of July with third Friday events.
And at that third Friday during it, they're going to unveil the new Frisco Festival poster and tell you who's going to be there. Big announcements. That happens at 5 tomorrow.
In downtown.
In Rogers. Yes.
Downtown Rogers.
Yes.
And this is Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I am Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Join us tomorrow for a brand new edition. Antoinette Grajeda will be with me as we have a new show.
Until then, thanks for listening.